This is Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, together with my co-host, Paul Wearson. Hello, Paul.
Well, we just heard some Louis Armstrong this morning. It's a great way to start the day. Now, next Saturday, this coming Saturday, is December 1st, so I'll bet we have a lot of events coming up related to Christmas and the season.
Well, you guessed it, Paul. But since we're still in membership mode, I'm also going to mention a few of the features of KHOI that our listeners may not be aware of. Our first guest, Ed Fallon, has been a regular guest during many marches and other actions to make people aware of climate change. But he also has a weekly one-hour show on KHOI from 4 to 5 p.m. on Wednesdays, Fallon Forum, on a variety of topics of interest to Iowans. Actually, Ed's on the air. Why don't you let him describe Fallon Forum? Is that okay, Ed?
Yeah, sure, of course. Good morning, everyone, and hope everybody's enjoying a slightly less frigid morning this day. Well, yeah, the Fallon Forum, our motto is to kind of offer the fusion of politics and civility, because so much of what's on radio these days is just is mean and very biased and very much playing into the whole divisiveness that is rampant in not just politics but in our society and world right now. And so the forum is intended to try to offer, maybe a more progressive perspective, but also to give opportunities for, contrary voices to discuss issues of importance. Yeah, we talk a lot about climate change, about the environment, but we talked about this week about the immigrant caravan that was greeted with tear gas at the U.S. border this week. We've talked about the G20 summit and how that might affect American workers. We talk about issues of equality and fairness and racial bias and a whole lot of stuff that you won't find on your typical commercial radio station.
So well,
we think it's a good offering.
Ed, this is Paul Wearson. I'm co-hosting with Susan today, and I know we did a lot of interviewing with you when you were on the march. And you were talking, too, about a book you've got out that's coming out very soon. It's called Marcher, Walker, Pilgrim. Tell us about that.
Well, I'm looking at a huge stack of boxes right here in my living room. The books just arrived. They literally are just out. And the official book launch will be this coming Sunday, December 2nd, at 2 o'clock in Des Moines. It'll be in the East Village, right above where Woolies is, if people know where that place is. But the book is about the Great March for Climate Action. It's specifically kind of my memoir from that experience. And this was in 2014, a group of, roughly 35 of us walked all the way from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C., coming through central Iowa. And it was, I tell you, it was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. And our goal was to raise awareness about climate change. And That certainly was the focus, but so many other things come into the conversation. A lot of personal revelations in my own life about spirituality, about love, about life itself, those come into play. The interesting and disturbing conflicts that develop among marchers come into play, as well as, and most importantly, the way climate change affected us as we marched, because we were experiencing the impacts of climate change regularly, even back then in 2014. And the other thing we saw was how climate change was affecting people we met along the route, how it was affecting places that we walked through. So I think it's a good book. I've worked hard on it. The message, again, is one intended to inspire people to get involved, but it's also, I've been told by people who've looked at it, a very interesting personal story, personal journey, and quite an amazing adventure when you think about the challenges of moving a big group of people across the country.
Now, it must have been quite an experience, Ed. Now, we did some interviews with you during the course of your march, and we've collected a series of those, and they're going to be airing on tomorrow, actually, Thursday, the Heart of Iowa program. And that was very interesting to encounter you on the march and interview you while you were going through all that. And just how long did it take to cross the country when you marched?
Now, we started on March 1st, and we finished on November 1st. And people think of Iowa as the middle of the country, but actually for us, it was two-thirds of the way across. When we got to Des Moines, we had, quote, only a third of the way left to go, another 1,000 miles to go to Washington, D.C. But, yeah, it was pretty grueling. And there were, you know, out of the group of roughly 35 people, there were five of us who made it every step of the way. Three from Iowa, myself, and then Jeffrey Sirwick, a Des Moines resident, and then Miriam Kashia, who amazingly was 71 years old at the time. She's from Iowa City, and incredibly, despite her age and incredible obstacles, she made it every step of the way.
Well, when you marched across Nebraska, it must have been like being at sea, right?
Actually, Nebraska was great. We had a wonderful time in Nebraska. A lot of people had mobilized to fight the Keystone Pipeline at that point. And what we saw was people, you know, not just progressives, but, you know, not just environmentalists, but a lot of people concerned about property rights, about the impact that the Keystone Pipeline might have on the aquifer. And so we met with a great reception in Nebraska. Actually, we spent more time in that state than any other. Arizona was a close second, but Nebraska was great. I'd walk through it again.
Did you encounter any hostility when you were on the march?
Occasionally, you know, especially among pickup truck drivers in Arizona. Sometimes the driving was aggressive. Occasionally, there was the one finger salute. There was a guy in California just as we were getting ready to cross the Mojave Desert who called us some words I can't say on an FCC-regulated radio station, but he basically thought we were nuts, both because we thought climate change was a concern and because we were going to spend the next 9 days walking across the Mojave Desert where there's nothing. So, we met a little bit of hostility. Mostly we met a lot of people who respected what we were doing, even people who disagreed with us on, you know, other issues. I remember one very conservative evangelical Christian family that I met with, and they were not only very interested, but they were very hospitable. They brought me over for key lime pie, and then they fed me a steak dinner, and we had a great conversation about how their faith, their Christian faith, instructed them to be concerned about our planet and our environment and about the people being affected by climate change. So, I'd say one thing that really impressed me about the march is we've got great people in this country, and this divide that is always being discussed and thrown in our faces, the red versus the blue, the Republicans versus the Democrats, the urban versus the rural, when you really immerse yourself in a community, you find that that divide is pretty artificial and that really we all have a lot more in common than the news media and the political establishment want us to believe.
Well, now, marches are really something that has developed into your thing. There's the Climate Justice March, the First Nation Climate Justice March. You're involved with Bold Iowa. What is that organization?
Well, Bold Iowa is a group focused. We grew out of the battle against the Dakota Access Pipeline, and our focus is to try to build coalitions that you don't normally expect. So we've worked hard to develop an alliance with landowners and farmers who might not, you know, share my own personal concern about climate change, but they understand the value of their land and their water, and also the importance of respecting property rights and not letting eminent domain be misused. So that was kind of the early constituency group that we tried to build an alliance with between environmentalists, landowners, farmers. And we've since really broadened that to with a strong focus on Native American leaders. We have some incredible leaders in this state who are doing amazing work. And we've built a strong alliance with them as well. Right now I'm trying to work to establish a stronger rapport with labor unions because, you know, labor unions and everyone else were on the opposite sides of the Dakota Access Pipeline issue. And we really think we should be together and have a lot more in common. And so I've been working with some of Iowa's labor leaders to try to find out how we can do a better job at working together in the future and not find ourselves on opposing sides something as important as a privately owned export oil pipeline.
Well, what I'm getting from you, Ed, is that you're a pretty moderate person when it comes to being open to other people and inviting them in and being non-confrontational in terms of seeking some sort of rapport with people who might differ with you in opinions. I salute that. That's a great idea. But I'm really glad to hear that in your experience in marching and meeting people across the country, that you really didn't see the sharp divide that we see so publicly displayed in the media. So that's encouraging me to hear you say that, Ed.
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly differences, but I think when you look at the really important stuff, you know, a safe food supply, clean water, affordable health care, all those things, that, you know, an infrastructure that serves people well, whether it's roads, bus lines, trains, all that stuff, that matters to people. And I think it isn't an issue of, you know, where you're from or what your political party is.
Well, I think the phrase that comes to mind that I grew up hearing a lot was the common good. What happens for the common good? What sort of rapport can we have to agree upon things that are important to each and every one of us? And how can we cohabitate and work together and collaborate to make things happen that indeed are for the common good? Because the polling data I've seen is that most people endorse a lot of these ideas, even though their politics might differ. The polling really shows that people support a lot of this stuff, you know?
Yeah.
That has to be encouraging.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, part of the problem is you've got such a, and politically, there's dominance of two political parties, and that kind of shuts out a lot of alternative voices and ideas. And then you've got a media situation where a very few large corporations control most of newspapers, most of the TV stations, and it's even more pronounced in the realm of radio. So that's why a station like KHOI is so important, and that's why I'm a sustaining member, supporter of KHOI. I donate $25 every month, and I hope more people will begin to do that, because It's incomparable how valuable having a community-owned station or even a local commercial station that has an investment in the community. You don't see that a lot anymore. A lot of these, the majority of broadcast signals are controlled by a couple really, really big corporations that have no connection to Iowa other than they own all these signals. And that's not good for democracy. It's not good for our community health and well-being, or for that matter, for our economy. So I hope more people think about the value of being a sustaining member of a station like KHOI.
Why, it's a changing world, as you pointed out. I remember when I was in radio early on in my college days at Luther College, I was program director of the radio station there, and we shared the transmitter with KDEC, the local commercial station, which was owned by two fine gentlemen. And I know that across Iowa and across the country, the old, what I would call, mom-and-pop radio stations have gone their way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really feel, as you do, and of course I'm here on a microphone at KHOI, so I'm biased about this, but I really think that when it comes to the common good and the ability to inform the public about what's going on locally and statewide and nationally is really falling to a very few radio stations now, and so we are proud at KHOI to be a part of that.
Yeah.
And I really hope that more people will come and join and be members, because, you know, we care about the things that the community cares about, and we're a voice for a variety of opinions and people who seek to come together to come to some sort of consensus about what can be done. Ed, what do you think the impact of the report that came out this week on climate change will be? Will that alter anyone's opinion who already have
It should. And, you know, we've already seen President Trump achieve some small momentum on climate change. He's gone from calling it a Chinese hoax to admitting that it's really happening. He's not willing to accept that it's driven by our fossil fuel consumption, as nearly every scientist is saying. But that's a small step forward. And hopefully the fact that this report is coming out, I know his initial reaction was he doesn't believe it's going to impact the economy, but it's impossible to accept what scientists are saying and not to see how it's going to impact us badly on a number of fronts. So my hope is that it's just one more reason, one more way in which people can understand that we've got a major problem on our hands. And that's, you know, that's again what I hope. My hope for my book is that as well. I mean, if people are brought into your reading Mark Your Walk or Pilgrim for the interest in the adventure of walking across the country, or if they're intrigued by the personal challenges that I face, the kind of the experiences that unfolded for me, that's great. I really hope that what they get out of it more than anything is that, yeah, we've got a little time and a lot of work to do to turn the country around when it comes to climate change.
Well, I really think
that's my biggest hope.
I really think that when you look at climate change and the folks who are deniers, very often it's a case of follow the money. You know, who pays and who has to expend money to alter what they're doing or change their practices. And those are the folks who really promote the idea that climate change is not a correct look at the world. There are people who are going to have to spend money to alter what they do as manufacturers or producers, and they're encouraging people to join them in denying climate change exists.
Yeah, but there's also tremendous economic opportunity in doing the right thing. You know, I don't know how much time we have, Paul, but if we have a couple, 3 minutes, I would share with the listeners a little section, a little segment from my book. And again, I'd love to invite people to the launch of the book this coming Sunday, December 2nd at 2 o'clock at Woolies, above Woolies in Des Moines. That's all. That can all be found on the Bold Iowa website. But do we have a few minutes where I might share a bit from the book?
Yeah, we have about 3 minutes or so.
Okay. So this is kind of the central message in the book, and it all kind of came together as me and one of the other marchers, Steve Martin, were walking across New Mexico. Here's what I wrote. After marching close to 1,000 miles through 3 states, my walking stick has become an essential companion. In addition to what I learned while training, I've become skilled in using it for balance, especially when walking through ravines or on sloping shoulders of gravel. In cities, I use it to push walk buttons, saving a few strides at road crossings. In rural areas, I use it to fling roadkill off highways. My walking stick also becomes an important part of the story I share with people I meet. One day, Steve and I ran out of water. "Look, there's a farmhouse ahead," I said. "First one we've seen in miles, and likely the last one we'll see before we die of thirst." "Nah," says Steve, "let's keep going. I don't want to bother the guy. We'll make it." "Okay," I say, you keep going, and I'll throw dirt over your parched corpse when I find you up the road later today." "Hello," I shout as we get close to the barn. A wiry, weathered Latino man, a bit older than me, steps out. "We're walking across the country," I say, "and we've run out of water. Would you happen to have a bit to spare?" "Sure," he said. "Walking across the country, what for?" he asked as he unkinked a hose to fill our bottles. "We're trying to get people to understand that we have to do something about climate change," I say. The farmer nodded his head and asked, "How far do you walk in a day?" "Oh, we've probably averaged 16 miles or so," I said. "Today we've got 18 to tackle." The farmer looked at my walking stick and said, "That's a good hike. I bet that stick helps." "It sure does," I affirmed. "It reminds me of my dad, who died of cancer a few years back. His coffin was made from the same forest that grew the wood for this walking stick." The farmer seemed genuinely interested, so I continued. "My dad used to tell me what it was like growing up in the Bronx during World War II, the son of Irish immigrants. Military experts warned of the horrible things happening in Europe and in the South Pacific. But our leaders just sat on their hands. Eventually, America woke up, and everybody did their part. My dad would go down to the railroad tracks and collect tin foil from cigarette boxes for the scrap metal drive." "Yeah," said the farmer. "My father fought in World War II. I was born a year after it ended, in fact. Not a coincidence, I guess," he said, smiling. "My dad, your dad, everyone got involved," I said. "As a nation, we retooled an entire economy in just a matter of months. We defeated fascism, and who knows what the world would look like today if we hadn't." There was a pause in the conversation as the farmer handed back our water bottles. We thanked him. Well, these times aren't that different, I said. It's time to wake up, like America did back then. We've got to listen to the experts, to the scientists who warn us of climate change. I paused, then continued. That's why we walk, to wake people up to what's going on before it's too late. The farmer was thoughtful as he stared at the ground. He glanced up, looked at my walking stick, shook his head slowly, and said, "That makes sense to me." And that story, first articulated in a barn in New Mexico, inspired by my dad and a hickory walking stick made by monks, became my core message during the rest of the march. I shared that message hundreds of times over the next 2,000 miles. It almost always resonated, a reminder of the power of stories in communicating with people about a crisis as urgent and yet intangible as climate change.
Oh, Ed, that's terrific. Gee, thanks for being with us today, Ed. And folks, we've been listening to Ed Fallon telling about the book he's launching this Sunday. And he just read an excerpt. It's Marcher, Walker, Pilgrim, his memoir from the 2014 Great March for Climate Action. The book launch is on December 2nd, Sunday, 2 o'clock at 500 East Locust in Des Moines. Thank you, Ed.
And thank you, Paul.
Thank you. And if you'd like to hear Ed's interviews with local talk hosts from the Great Climate March for the Great March for Climate Action, tune in tomorrow, Thursday, November 29th at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. to our special Heart of Iowa broadcast. This is the time to remind you that if you value this unique community, or if you're learning about things you never thought you'd hear on radio, your contributions are what keep us on the air. You can become a member at $55 per year, or a sustaining member, like Ed is, at now he says his gift is $25 per month, which of course would take us above that $250 per year mark, we had the idea that every new sustaining member like that of $250 or more is eligible to receive a hardcover copy of Marcher, Walker, Pilgrim with color photographs and a personalized signature. Just tell us how you would like to have it inscribed by Ed Fallon. We have just six of these. That would translate into $1,500. Call us at 515-292-2878, that's 515-292-2878, to reserve your copy and tell us how you want it signed. Or stop in at 410 Douglas to talk to one of our volunteers. This is just one example of how KHOI is more than a radio station. We've not only followed Ed's marches as news stories, we joined him on all of his marches. This is building a community, not only with others concerned about climate change, but the farmers who are still fighting eminent domain abuse, and above all, with Indigenous people. When the First Nation Climate Justice March was in Ames, I met a number of the Indigenous marchers and recorded the following stories, including Christine Nobis, founder of Indigenous Iowa, and Lakosha, a veteran who had been at Standing Rock. Here is what they had to say.
Christine is the director of Indigenous Iowa and the founder of that. And she has been so important to make sure that we have come together in a positive way.
I believe you are one of the organizers of this march. Is that right?
Yes, I am. I am the Indigenous organizer on this march. And I'm Plains Cree Salto from the George Gordon First Nation, and I grew up in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, and I've been living in Iowa for 12 years now. I founded Indigenous Iowa because I saw a real need for a larger Indigenous voice in Iowa, because this state was cleared out pretty viciously, and there's not a lot of Indigenous people living outside of like the Meskwaki settlement or outside of Sioux City that are being heard, you know. And I just felt that this was a really colonized state, both biologically, culturally, socially, physically, you know, in terms of genocide and removal and assimilation, that it was important to start raising awareness and bringing a presence like to like what people would call like not Indian country, you know, like where there's not a lot of indigenous people like residing. But that's not to say that like there's not a really strong presence within the Meskwaki settlement nation and Sioux City, but they're small as well. And so I just want to be standing side by side with them and working in solidarity with them and, you know, doing what we can to like move forward past this colonial system that's really broken us down and hurt us tremendously.
Did you come to Little Creek from Standing Rock?
No, I founded Little Creek. I guess you could say I came to it from Standing Rock, but I live here. So I wanted to continue to fight the pipeline. I didn't think the fight was over because there was still construction going on in Iowa at the time. And also we had the court case coming up. And so I just felt it was necessary to bring more attention to the fact that we still had a fighting chance to beat this corporate conglomerate that has basically privatized the profit but socialized the risk for the people.
Were you instrumental in bringing the First Nation Farmer Climate Unity March together?
Yes. Ed and I talked some time ago about founding, you know, like something akin to the Indian Cowboy Alliance that started a while ago but is dissolved at this point. And we just said, you know, like with climate change, the people that we need to listen to the most are indigenous people and the farmers. They are really connected to the land in a way that a lot of people are not. Even though farmers are mostly settler descendants and have colonized land that's been taken from indigenous people, at this point, we need to work in unity and in solidarity because we are literally burning up. And, like, we need to find some sort of unity to stop what's going on at this right now.
My name's Lakasha. That's short for Lakasha Yokol Lakipt. And in the Nez Perce language, that has a rough translation to touches lightning. So that's where my name comes from. However, on paper, due to federal recognition, I am enrolled in the Cayuse Nation from Pendleton, Oregon. To add to that, my bloodline derives from Chugach, Alaska, along with Wasco in Central Oregon, and Nez Perce and Cayuse, of course, and then Klamath from Southern Oregon, and Yaqui from Arizona.
How did you get here?
Funny story. So I was out at Standing Rock in 2016 from the end of August, early September to February during the eviction. I was contacted to help transport supplies to Little Creek Camp. I'm sure some of us may be familiar with that. And so I transported supplies down here to establish Little Creek. But the funny thing was, though, at Standing Rock, a lot of people would ask me where I come from. And as you may remember from my bloodline, I told people I come from Iowa, but it was on an acronymical level, right? It was Idaho, Oregon, Washington, and Alaska. I never thought that I would end up in Iowa transporting supplies for an additional camp to resist the DAPL pipeline. And I came down here. I've been fortunate to experience the black squirrels, the fireflies, cardinals, very beautiful, and the humidity. You know, out of I'd put it in the top three. I spoke of a winter in a teepee and Standing Rock. That was, you know, an extreme. A summer in Iraq, okay, and then humidity of Iowa. And those are my three extremes there.
How did you get to spend your summer in Iraq?
I joined the United States Marine Corps at a young age, and I was augmented to the 11th MEU Marine Corps or Marine Expeditionary Unit, and went over in 2004 and came back in 2005, thankfully.
So you've had quite a bit of life experience thus far.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. It's been very hard to difficult and actually wrap my head around the whole thing. I think joining the military, I seen a way out from the average reservation conditions for a male. And to put it plainly, I had a better chance at surviving in Iraq than on a reservation, a Native American reservation here in the United States. Fortunately, I was able to come home. But with that, it was very difficult, and I still deal with it today because ultimately I feel as if I was colonizing Iraq under the orders of the United States. And it's very, very hard for me as an indigenous person of this continent to come to an acceptance of that. And, you know, even with that, like being at Standing Rock, to watch our own military come in on us again.
This is KHOI Community Radio 89.1 FM, and you just heard from Lakosha, one of the indigenous voices from the First Nation Farmer Climate Unity March that came through Ames earlier this year, organized by Ed Fallon and Bold Iowa and Indigenous Iowa. Today on Local Talk, we are promoting a variety of programs you might have missed on KHOI. Following the Indigenous Connections, we're playing a clip from Alan Gildhouse, or DJ Gildy, host of KHOI's Rock of Ages, interviewing one of our syndicated hosts, Larry Kay, who brings us Indigenous in Music at 2 p.m. on Tuesday afternoons.
So I got started in Minneapolis, Minnesota. We moved the show to a radio station in Minneapolis. It was a community station, KFAI. And I had the program there for probably about 4 years. And then I decided I was actually moving from Minneapolis to Florida. So I decided to pack up. I shut the show down for about maybe 3-4 weeks. I come here to Sarasota, and I'm driving down the road, and I'm turning on the radio station, and it was a Saturday, and I heard powwow music, Indian powwow music. And I thought, no way, not here in Sarasota. So I called up the station, and I said, I got a lot of music for you. I got tapes, I got rock and roll, you name it, of all genres of, indigenous art musicians. And right away they said, well, can you take your show and bring it to our station? So back in 2000, I moved the show from Minneapolis to Sarasota, and we were broadcasting on another little station here, WSLR. And then a year ago, I had about 30 stations, probably about 20 back then, that were playing my show. So I decided just to move it from the station into the Two Buffalo Studios. So now we broadcast out of our own studios. And here I am today, 10 years later. And we're on about 30 stations around the country, and we're soon to be picked up by the Native Voice One, and they got about 150 stations, so we're going to be spread across the country, which is great.
Larry, this is Gildy. How are you this afternoon?
Hi, Gildy. How are you? I'm doing good.
I'm great. So when you started the show in Minneapolis, that was indigenous music as well? That was Native American music as well? Or did you transfer that once you got to Sarasota? Was it always an indigenous music theme to begin with?
Yes, definitely. It's always been mostly it started off with American Indians because that's who I was, my big connection was. But then as we grew, now I interview from Central America, South America.
So all over the world, literally, because yeah. I've listened to the show several times over the last couple of weeks, mostly because I truly enjoy it, but also to prepare for this interview. And I've heard music from Native Americans to Brazil to all over the place. I think I even heard some from the Australia as well. And it's just fascinating. I love the show personally. Has community radio been the drive for you from the start, or was it radio in general and you just graduated to the idea of community radio? Because here in Ames, this is one of the first community radio stations that Ames in this area has had, and it is, in my personal opinion, KHOI is probably the finest you can find. There's 3 or 4 in the state, but we are KHOI. So has community radio been your drive from the start?
Yes. definitely, from 2006. Because what happened was we didn't have a recording studio, so the local community radio let me come in and use their studios. And then they liked it so much, they said, well, hey, we want to air it. So then it was just a half-hour program, though. It was just interviews. And then when we came to Florida, I bumped it up to a full two-hour program. And it's always been indigenous in music. The funny thing is my last name is Knutson, and I'm American Indian, and I'm also part Danish, so that Knutson is a Danish name. And here I am in Sarasota, Larry Knutson, and I thought, well, that doesn't sound very Indian, so I dropped the Knutson for Larry K, and it turned out okay.
That seems to work all right. I must admit that I am an absorber and a noticer of accents, and quite frankly, the minute you opened your mouth, I knew you were from somewhere here in the Midwest, and it had to be there because of the long O's, you know.
People know that, too. They go, you're from up north, aren't you? I go, oh, yeah. I was down here one day, and some ladies knew right away, you're from Minneapolis. I didn't know we had an accent, but I guess we do.
Yeah, nobody knows they have an accent until they get right out of their neighborhood, and everybody looks at them like they're talking funny.
So now, how long have you guys been airing the show? It's great to have you guys on board.
Evan, when did we pick up the show?
We've had the show for about as long as I've been here, and that's been about 15 months and a bit longer even. I think we've had it for between 2 and 2.5 years at this point.
Nice. That's good to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's definitely something that we enjoy having. I think, by and large, in my opinion anyway, just because of the sheer variety of music that you pick up. I mean, Gildy was talking about how he's hearing a little bit of everything from everywhere. I mean, You've got everything from pan flute music to Carlos Santana. And I got to say, I love it, Larry.
And I try to pick new music, but there's lots of old music that we haven't even heard yet, so...
And you know what's so interesting is that I'm an old rock and roll guy from age 12, and listening to all of the groups that my older brothers would listen to, and so on and so forth. And I've been listening to Carlos since I was 12. And honestly, until I started hearing Carlos on your show, it never even dawned on me to think about Carlos Santana in terms of indigenous music. But he takes so many... He has taken and continues to take so many influences from so many root music sources that it truly is, especially something like from his most recent album, the song Yambo. It's just amazing and so educational for me to think about, okay, I've been thinking of Carlos Santana in terms of Oye Como Va and Black Magic Woman.
Yeah.
When... So much of the rest of it is so deeply influenced from so many other places. Talk about that. Talk about Carlos in particular for a minute, if you could.
Well, Carlos did an album, Shapeshifter. It was the album prior to his latest release, and he donated all the money and proceeds to the American Indian. I'm not sure exactly what foundation it went to, but all proceeds of that album went. And I thought that was really nice, and I was trying to get him on the show. It's really hard to get on, but I have a feeling once I get to the big network, I can get him. I can just about get anybody on the show. But yeah, I like Carlos. I've been listening to him. Like, I don't know how old you are, but I'm up to there. I'm in my 50s, and I remember, like you said, Black Magic Woman. The Moonflower album was the coolest album I ever heard, and I still play it to this day on the show because it's half live and half studio. But that was my biggest influence, was the Moonflower album. And
I broke my teeth. I broke my teeth on Abraxas, personally, but I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So it's fantastic. And the importance of community radio, let's talk about that for a second, about how a resource that is solely focused and built and created for the community where from one comes, like...
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of my guests are from the small little town, so it works. It fits right with my show. Community radio is the way to go.
Yeah. And we are, as you know, in the midst of our fall fundraiser, and it's so important that we talk about these sorts of things. We as a station and you as a programmer, we're not beholden to any of the major big companies, big organizations, right, whatever. We depend upon those who value what we do every day to allow us to do this. And it's, yeah. Is it or is it not just the greatest pleasure you can think of. I mean, I often say somewhere along the lines, the owners and operators of this station had a momentary lapse of reason and gave me 2 hours to play with. And how great is that?
Oh, I don't even know the word. I just know because of the listeners and their support, that's why me and you are here today. And it's all about our listeners. And so we can bring them great programming. They'll help support us and keep us going for a long time. I'm not going anywhere, so I'll definitely be in Ames, Iowa for a few more years.
That's Paul Wirsett at KHOI. We're in Local Talk today, talking about a variety of subjects. And, of course, we're getting into the Christmas season, and there are a lot of events coming up that are going to be very interesting, fun, and very seasonal, too. And we just talked about a lot of things regarding marches and all the kinds of things that are being done to create awareness. And we just had the Moonflower was played by, that was by Santana, one of Larry Kay's favorites. And I can't say it's familiar to me, but it certainly broadens my idea of indigenous music.
It also sounds different from most of the music we're going to hear this weekend as the Christmas season really gets started. Before we close out the show with a rundown from around the area, I believe you have a guest from Story City on the line.
Yes, we have Tammy.
Hello, Paul.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, I'm just going to be very excited about children's theater coming up in Story City again.
Absolutely.
It's the Velveteen Rabbit, and I know the Velveteen Rabbit was big in the 70s. I was on the board at the YMCA in Des Moines. We had a program director, Wayne Fieldhouse, who had a great presentation for children on the Velveteen Rabbit. But for those of us who weren't alive in the 70s, tell us about the Velveteen Rabbit. What's the plot line of this program?
Well, it is a story set in the late Victorian era, and it surrounds a young girl named Andrea who was given a Velveteen Rabbit as a Christmas gift. And as Andrea grows to love this rabbit, she spends all of her time with it. It plays with her. It sleeps with her. She's with Rabbit constantly. And as a result of the love that Andrea gives, this rabbit becomes real. And in the second act, Andrea contracts scarlet fever. And as a result, all of her toys need to be burned. But because the love she had for her rabbit becomes a real bunny and is able to live out his life in the woods. So on one hand, it's a little bit dark. You know, a lot of our actors are dead by the end of the play. But it really is. It is a beautiful, heartwarming story about love and the power of love.
You've got me tearing up already, Tammy. Now, you have two performances on this coming weekend. You have a 2 o'clock performance on Saturday, December 1st, and one Sunday, December 2nd. And that'll be at the high school auditorium.
Yes, we are performing at the high school auditorium. And there are tickets available at the door. It's $5 per head.
Now, how many kids are involved in this program?
Oh, golly, we have got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 18 children are involved. Our oldest one is an eighth grader, and our youngest one is a kindergartner.
A kindergartner. Now, these folks are all memorizing lines and doing
they
all the things.
They are indeed. In fact, our younger ones are the ones who have their lines down first.
Wow. Is that true?
Now, yes, it is. It's wonderful. But yeah, there are no adults on stage. It's all children. The adults are backstage, but it's the kids on stage.
That's wonderful. And you're sitting there watching, biting your nails, making sure nothing goes wrong, right?
You know, whatever happens is going to happen, and they have worked so hard. They have worked so very hard learning their lines and learning their blocking, and they are beyond excited right now. We have dress rehearsal tomorrow night, and I've gotten messages from the kids. They're just so stoked about performing this play.
Well, you know, I've done a lot of community theater, and when adults are involved, a sense of community evolves among the cast because people are working together in a project very intimately and have to really cooperate to a high degree.
Absolutely.
I bet that's happened with the kids, right? There's a little family developing here.
It really has. And the kids have worked outside of rehearsal time with each other. They'll FaceTime each other and rehearse scenes. And I've got a couple that are in the same study halls at the middle school, and they'll get together and run lines during study halls.
Yeah, you really don't have to motivate children.
They're
on to this project, and they're ready to go.
Exactly.
And they do all this extra work outside of rehearsal. I bet you're impressed by their work ethic, aren't you, Tim?
Oh, my gosh. They are so amazing, and they have such a commitment to do a really good job. And they are incredibly easy to direct.
Wow. You're having fun, too, I can tell.
Oh, my gosh. We're having a blast. Mary McMullen is my assistant director. She graduated from Roland's Story last year.
Wow.
And so keeping Mary out of trouble by helping me with JSTT Children's Theater. So that's a lot of fun.
Well, we are anxious to go. I'm going to be there myself for Sunday's performance.
So wonderful.
I'm going to miss opening, but I'll be there for the second show.
That's
is the Velveteen
wonderful.
Rabbit Children's Theater at Story City. Judge Story Theatrical Troupe is involved, I believe. And
yes, it is.
It'll be at 2 o'clock, both Saturday afternoon, December 1st, and Sunday afternoon, December 2nd, at Roland Story High School Auditorium. Thank you very much, Tammy.
Thank you, Paul. We'll see you this weekend.
Break a leg.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Nuestra luna ilumina toda la noche. Todos duermen en silencio toda la noche. Gentilmente y en silencio se revelan sentimientos. Se respira un aire puro toda la noche. Sobre el heno mi rey duerme toda la noche. Las estrellas lo acompañan toda la noche. El futuro rey observa nuestra paz. Jesús preserva. Se respira un aire santo toda la noche. Toda la noche.
I'd like to get a few snapshots of what's happening throughout our listening area now. And I want to emphasize this is only announcements about this Saturday and Sunday. There's more happening later in the month, but I thought we'd just stick for this weekend. A little reminder, though, that it's not a Christmas event, but the Central Iowa Symphony has its performance on Saturday, the 1st of December, and it's Smiles, Laughs, and Ecstatic Outbursts. You heard about that last week, so we're just going to go into Christmas this week. Besides going to the Velveteen Rabbit this weekend, Story City is holding the 33rd Yule Fest Tour of Homes on Saturday and Sunday between 1 and 4 p.m. It's a traditional event for the Christmas season. And St. Petri and Emmanuel Lutheran Churches are both selling baked goods on December 1st. I think they're probably sort of vying for the sweet tooths in Story City. December 1st is also the date for Jewel's Holiday Festival at the Jewel Gold Club, Gold Course Clubhouse. I think this is a golf course, and I'm, where the 2018 wreath auction will be held. The Iowa Arboretum will start this Saturday with a breakfast of Belgian waffles from 9 to noon, Art Mart from 9 to 3, and the opening of Winterfest with Iowa-grown trees decorated by local clubs, schools, and organizations. In Nevada, the Talent Factory Regulars Christmas Show will be held on Saturday, December 1st at 7 p.m., and they have a lot more throughout the month that we'll talk about later. Legacy Learning in Webster City has an unusual event, Snowman Guided Painting, on December, 1st, I think, from 2 to 4 at Backcountry Winery near Stratford, Iowa. In Ames, there are three Christmas concerts this weekend. On December 1st, the Ames Children's Choir will sing at 3 p.m. at Collegiate United Methodist Church. On December 2nd, Good Company, the Women's Choir, at 7 p.m., St. Andrew's Lutheran Church. And December 2nd, 3 p.m., University Choirs and Orchestra Holiday Concert at C.Y. Stevens. So,
well, there's all kinds of activities coming up, and I know that this is just the first weekend of December, and you'll be notified, all our audience out there, of all the other activities coming up throughout the Christmas season. You know, I just love Christmas and all the activities. Now, at Story City, we have the big Christmas tree in the square, and my grandfather, Oscar Henderson, is one of the people who began that, I think, about 1913. And our engineer here, Cindy, is wearing a great Christmas hat to remind us of the Christmas season. And, you know, this is just a wonderful festive time of the year when people do all kinds of things for other people, and there are all kinds of benefits going on. There are all kinds of things that people go out, for instance, at my church tonight, we're baking cookies to be sold, and we're going to use that money to do the Angel Tree gift shopping for a needy family. And we'll have all these middle school kids making cookies. And then next week we go out, or early in December anyway, we go out with all the kids to do this shopping for this family. And you take a herd of middle school kids and high school kids into a store, and they have the names of the children and their sizes and everything. And so the kids buy for that specific family. And it's fun to watch them bake the cookies tonight. It's fun to watch them go shopping. And I know that experience is replicated through all the communities here in Story County and all the kids and churches and organizations that are really helping people in need during the Christmas season. And I love the Christmas music. I never get tired of it. The Christmas concerts are great. However, this all ends at the end of December, and we go into January and February. We urgently need some sort of winter festival in February to keep us sane. And I have to invent one of those where everyone comes out and does concerts again because we're dying in the cold. But this is the Christmas season, and we're so blessed to be involved again with all the wonderful activities of the Christmas season. So, Susan, take it away.
Okay. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Paul Wearson and I, Susan Franzen, have been your hosts for today. Other voices you heard were Ed Fallon, Christine Nobis, LaKosha, Ellen Gildhouse, Evan Taylor, Larry Knudsen, also known as Larry Kay, and Tammy Dickinson Farrell.
Well, you can listen to today's Local Talk Show and any of our past Local Talk Shows online at our website, khoyfm.org. There you will find also information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. That's khoyfm.org. There are also rebroadcasts of this morning's show at noon and 7 p.m.
Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Moonflower by Santana from the CD Moonflower and Toda la Noche.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. And if you would like to join the team here as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-7878. Or contact us through our website, khoyfm.org. So call us at 292-2878. And that's also on our website where you need to know to contact us if you decide to become a member or renew your membership today. Just look for the yellow donate button on our website and donate.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and
see you again on the radio.
Support for KHOI is provided in part by Stevens Auditorium, presenting the Nutcracker, Saturday, December 8th at 1:30 and 7:30 p.m., and Sunday, December 9th at 1:30 p.m. Tickets and more information can be found at center.iastate.edu.